This is an interview with Martin David on November 4th, 1981. I'm Laura Smail, and we're talking in his office.
Yes, you asked me to remember about the origins of the Social Systems Research Institute at the university and its relation to developments in the social sciences. And I can give you some picture of what happened between September 1962 and the present as far as the Social Systems Research Institute is concerned. And I think it's a very interesting chapter in quantitative social science. I believe that the Institute was founded before I arrived at Wisconsin in 62. I'm not absolutely positive. If not, it was founded during the first year I was here, which was 1962-63. Mm-hmm. And Guy Orcutt was the organizer, and he established a board for the SSRI, which included members from a variety of schools and departments somewhat distant to the social science departments that were the center core of the Institute. I've forgotten what this board was called, but the thought was that it would have some kind of advisory and executive functions over the general direction of research in the Institute, and that by reaching out into a number of different schools, the SSRI would in fact be able to coordinate research that was ongoing in places as different as I think industrial engineering. Jerry Nadler was one of the members of the early board. There was certainly a representative from the School of Commerce. There was someone from agriculture, I know, and you can find that in the early reports of the Institute, just what that board was. Now, the Institute was, I think, a creature of Guy Orcutt's fertile imagination, and he viewed it as a holding company for quantitative research in the social sciences. And he was very much taken with the idea that the computer was a major tool for understanding behavior. That was the first thing. And the second thing was that the computer could be used as a very powerful tool for integrating knowledge by taking observed behavioral relationships and incorporating them into simulation models. And so part of his conception of the Institute was there should be centers within the Institute that concentrated their efforts on different aspects of human behavior. Mm-hmm. There was a center for research on household behavior, which Art Goldberger was a leader in it for some time. I was a leader in it for some time. There was a center for research on demography and human ecology, and Ryder, forgot his first name.
Norm
Ryder was the head of that. There was a center for the study of statistics and methodology. And Arnold Zellner was the head of that for a period of time, another center for the study of firm behavior. And then initially the notion was that on a voluntary basis, any people who wished could affiliate themselves with these centers, and each center had a set of discussion papers that it issued, and an agenda for work relating to Orcutt's model. And I really am not sure exactly how other people felt about Orchid's model early on. I was very enthusiastic about it. Here was the notion that we knew that people lived in families. We knew that those families were affected by economic events in terms of important demographic phenomena like age at marriage and size of families. We knew something about the demands that families had for goods and services, and it really seemed in that area that there was enough data and enough research on behavioral reactions that you could begin to pull together something in the way of a simulation model of households. And with my own background from the Michigan Institute for Social Research, it seemed like kind of a logical next step from research work that I had been doing and gathering data on families and analyzing expenditure mm-hmm. patterns and so on. Well, that meant that confounded with the Social Systems Research Institute as a holding company for quantitative social research were Orchid's own interests in simulation modeling, and to the extent that he put resources from his grant support into the Institute, some people came to see it as Orchid's empire. And certainly, even with in economics, the economics department, where one would imagine the greatest possible commonality of research methodologies, there were some real questions about what the appropriate strategy was. Guy underestimated the enormous task that was really involved in doing the kind of thing that we now do in 1981 with the considerable speed and precision, namely taking a population of individuals and families, subjecting them to different kinds of laws, tax laws, welfare laws, and making some kind of an estimate of what the population response is going to be to its environment. That sort of thing is now firmly embedded in the decision-making of the executive and the Congress in the welfare area, and also to some extent in the tax area. Well, Guy wanted to construct these models, and it meant having a computer that would contain data on thousands of families, that would contain the software for organizing the information on those families into a set of routines that would determine demographic change, important decisions like labor supply and expenditure decisions, and so on. And so a good deal of Guy's effort was focused on improving the computer capabilities for the university, and he certainly played a role along with Wayne Rayfield and who was the man before him with the red hair who went to the World Bank with him, I can't remember.
The
head of the computing center for a while. In getting computer capacity. And
was it Merv Muller?
Merv Muller.
Oh,
yeah.
It was.
Yeah. And so one of the things that happened at that time was it was clear the physicists had their ideas of what kind of computer capacity was needed for studying tracking and nuclear phenomena. But there wasn't an organized demand for computer services from the social sciences, and so there was a real gap in terms of understanding the way in which social sciences would relate to computation, and I'll come back to that. So Guy invested a considerable amount of money in hiring programmers to work on simulation programs and to work on some basic statistical routines. And as a result of that effort, we have a program which was later incorporated into the university's stat job, which is well known for being a precise statistical program. And we have there were two programs, one a cross-tabulation program, one a regression program, and people in the economics department also contributed to that effort. Arnold Zellner contributed a great deal to sophisticated estimation techniques, two- and three-stage least squares techniques. So adapting the computer to social sciences was made a very high priority agenda item for the SSRI. Well, this put the SSRI in the business of programming, in the business of handling scientists' computer needs, and in the business of relating to computation costs. So there was kind of an operational side to it. The intellectual side was much more that the overhead that was required to produce working papers and distribution of new ideas was incorporated into distribution of preprints and reprints, which got rather wide circulation at one point in time. And that function of SSRI has continued in relatively unchanged form to the present. The volume of papers involved is somewhat smaller now, but the emphasis has began and has continued to be papers on problems in the frontier of mathematical economics, estimation methods in economics, and applied economics involving relatively large bodies of information or relatively sophisticated application of econometric methods to data. About 1964, I guess, Guy made a big push to try to assemble data on households into a computerized model. And as a result of that, there were a number of first-class dissertations done on investment behavior by households in durable goods, and the behavior of households in buying housing. And some things were done to try and create a demographic model in which one would have solved the problems of how do we account for the number of births and deaths in the population, and age the decision-making units by a year as time passes. And I guess this was sort of an intermediate point at which there was a lot of enthusiasm for this computerized modeling. However, I think, as was probably inevitable, the longer people worked on this, the more people felt that there were alternative approaches. And Zellner concentrated a great deal of effort in trying to do we would call it a cohort analysis now, I think, of data on households in which one would try to combine information from surveys with time series data to produce results of considerably more detail than the path-breaking econometric models of the time. And in fact, I should, you know, footnote that Arthur Goldberger, who came here in, I think, 59, but maybe it was 60, either one or the 2 years, had done most of the actual computation involved in the Klein-Goldberger model, which was then the state of the art as far as making predictive estimates of what was going on in the U.S. economy. And there was a great deal of enthusiasm for what you could get out of these models in terms of predictions and forecasts, and people thought with a modicum of refinement, a good deal of accuracy and forecasting could be developed. So Zellner was pursuing this more aggregative philosophy, and eschewed the notion of simulation modeling at the micro level, which was really Guy Orkut's dream. His notion was the only way to understand the world was to get a representation of how the individual actors in the world behave, and to the extent there was a lack of understanding, to incorporate the variability of our understanding in the modeling process. So Zellner used his role in the SSRI to develop a number of very fine dissertations and develop a good deal of creative talent in the Institute, but his direction kind of moved off from Guy's. Goldberger became increasingly interested in estimation problems and the theory of how econometrics proceeded, and did some consolidation in that field, and the first, well, a textbook that was the landmark for at least a decade came out of that. And one can imagine that Orkut was a little bit frustrated that he had put a great deal of money into this institute that he had raised on his personal reputation, and what seemed to be coming out were tangential products rather than the product he had envisaged. Well, by the time 1965 rolled around, I think there was also some difficulty with the foundations. They were wondering when the payoff was going to come from this activity, and the demographic model that Orkut was able to construct was very modest by comparison with the original claims. And so I think at some juncture about that level there was clear warnings on the horizon that the level of funding was going to decline. So in 1966, Orkut prepared a report to the Ford Foundation, which maybe you've seen, which expressed dismay at the failure to support his ideas adequately, and expressed a great need for an order of magnitude more funding for these kinds of things. And I think that reflected to some extent his impatience with his own colleagues and his ability to organize his own colleagues. In any case, it was perhaps a premonition of the fact that he was thinking in terms of the fact that other environments might be more suitable to the further development of his ideas. And I don't know just exactly when he left, but it must have been 66 or 67.
Well, he actually left in 1970, but I think he went off for a year.
He went off for two years.
To the World Bank.
He was at the World Bank for 2 years. And he spoke very enthusiastically when he was leaving, because he thought that with the new leadership from McNamara and the McNamara's interest in what was happening to populations and distribution of income, that there was going to be real scope for applying his ideas on a worldwide level. He actually only stayed with the bank for 1 year, and then he went to the Urban Institute, because, in fact, although he and Merv Muller both went to the bank, he encountered bureaucratic resistance to his ideas at the bank, and didn't see enough movement generating to support what he was doing. And the sort of postscript to this is that one of the models that has been used for welfare simulations is a derivative of this original version of the demographic model that was started here at Wisconsin and was developed at the Urban Institute from the beginnings that we had here. Well, the centrifugal forces in this organization centered around Norm Ryder and his institute, and for reasons that I don't understand at all, I think maybe in 64, the Center for Human Ecology and Demography split off from the SSRI entirely, and those whose research was primarily in demographic and demographically related fields was divorced from SSRI. Well, the notion of the SSRI as a holding company for social science research persisted for a good long time, and it did become a mechanism for people to process grants through the university. It took on a number of projects in that way that maybe were not so central to either the idea of simulation modeling or the notion of developing social science methodology. But there was some confusion, I think organizational confusion, about the role of the department vis-a-vis the role of an institute in providing the overhead for it. And given that there were some university resources put into the Social Systems Research Institute, it seemed reasonable to spread around the advantage of that to a broad group of faculty members. Also, it's true that although there were a couple of political scientists involved in the early days, and Orchid was eager to see quantitative political science, such as the sort of voter studies and studies of bureaucratic behavior and allocations to government, come out of organized research. For some reason, that particular bond never prospered, and indeed, my impression is that within the political science department, a series of relatively talented young people who were interested in quantitative analysis found it difficult to progress and moved on. It's people like Edgar Browning and Charles Knudy and I've lost the third name. So, as time progressed, there's kind of a peeling away, as it were, of the onion, leaving economics where it always was in the center of this organization, excluding anyone from outside, really. And then in 1971, I was the director of the SSRI, and at that time it was clear that in some ways the original vision and the organizational capabilities of the Institute had gotten out of whack, and that there were some people in the economics department who didn't feel that there should be any group claiming to provide a support role for economic research in general, and they thinking that there was some kind of a loss that would follow if people in the department were guided in the direction of putting their research through the Institute. And so what evolved at that point in time was a major reorganization in which a group of faculty that was indeed concentrated on matters of mathematical, statistical, and theoretical importance to the development of economic thought emerged as the membership of SSRI, a group of somewhere between 15 and 20, and that size group is the group that has persisted to the present. And the principal functions of the Institute at this point in time are the maintenance of a very high quality secretarial facility, which provides what doesn't appear to be a big resource to the outside world, but which one can really document as being very important. And the only parallel organization I can think of is the Coles Foundation at Yale, where they've had a secretariat that is in tune with the kinds of requirements of theoretically oriented, quantitatively oriented economists, and the fact that you have people who are skilled in dealing with papers that have a great deal of abstract symbolic content makes a big difference in the efficiency with which people can think and their capacity for getting results out. And so that's been the primary asset of SSRI. They've maintained that capability over this entire period of time. In the meantime, long before the attrition in the membership, which I referred to in 72, or 71, the programming functions and the computer-related functions were divested from the Institute. This had to do with the termination of Guy's presence here on the campus. When he no longer had funds to cover that operation, it had to become self-supporting. It then seemed as if it would be useful to set up an independent organization to handle the budgetary consequences. And the result of that was the organization that has gone under a variety of names. It was called the Computer Program Advisory and Computing Services for some time, and it was ultimately merged into what is now the Data and Computation Center. Now, so one of the motives behind this was to get financial accountability, to make it easy for anyone to avail themselves of computer services, and to give the university administration a little more control over what programmers were there. The administration insisted that that be done outside of the SSRI because they viewed the SSRI as somehow being captive to the research strategies and ideologies of Guy Orchid.
Mm. Are you talking at the chancellor's level or the dean's level?
Well, I think this is probably at the dean's level. Mm. I'm not sure. There was another development that parallels all this, which is Orchid was very keen on the notion that in order to do this kind of research, one had to acquire data series, and he was thinking of data in the form of observations on individual behavior that could be analyzed here and studied intensively. And you want to stop?
Yeah, I guess we might as well.
That the SSRI assembled all of the data that had been collected by the Survey Research Center, and that contributed to a number of these theses I mentioned earlier on. He proceeded to assemble time series data from various sources, and they're developed here what might be one of the first major libraries of machine-readable data. And back in 1966, but it might be 1968, there was a need to spin that operation out of SSRI, and the graduate school undertook supporting that operation, and again they felt that if they were going to put some money into the operation, they did not wish it to be part of an institute, and that goes back to a graduate school philosophy that has been very strong the entire time I've been here, that graduate school research support goes to individual professors and not to providing some kind of overhead or ancillary support or core money for institutes or the support of non-teaching faculty.
Mm-hmm.
So the only terms for getting graduate school participation in the data library were to make the data library separate. That became the Data and Program Library, and the name tells you its activities. It was acquiring information from sources off campus and archiving information on campus, and it's really very fortunate that we've had an extremely capable person in the leadership of that activity over the last, 12, 13 years, and that is Alice Robin. And so, although Wisconsin, in the event, did not turn out to be a major data collector, it has been a major innovator in the techniques that data libraries should be using for managing their data systems. So, ultimately, the Data and Program Library Service were combined with the Programming and Advisory Consulting Service into what is now the DACC, and the support for that activity is now largely funding from the College of Letters and Sciences. What it has meant is that we've been able from a very early time to have a remote computer terminal in the social science building. We've had consultants who have communicated with social scientists on problems and data processing, and as I suggested earlier, the programming group was alert to some of the problems that the social science community faced in dealing with the computer. And another very innovative thing that was done, begun at SSRI and ultimately completed through the MACC, is a program called the Unified Data Handler, which makes it convenient to work with large and complex data files and obtain information on subpopulations and particular domains of interest from material that is heavily condensed on computer tapes. So, although the SSRI has now a very concentrated role in economics and relatively little interdisciplinary activity, there were these various components that go back to the early history that established important quantitative bases for other disciplines. The Center for Human Demography and Ecology, or Demography and Human Ecology, I think it's called, ultimately became the recipient of a major core grant for a data processing facility for census materials, and that's what's now the Demography and Ecology Center, that has its own computer capabilities on the fourth floor of social science. And indeed, it's somewhat ironic that after pushing so hard to enhance the computer facilities of the university for the benefit of social science, that we somehow, for institutional reasons, came around full circle to where a group that split out of the Social Systems Research Institute ended up with its own captive computer and considerably better terms for its research than what was available to the remainder of the SSRI. Well, I guess the story of this evolution wouldn't be complete without mentioning the Poverty Institute, and I may not be able to answer all your questions, but one aspect of it is very important, and that is the interest by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare in having a think tank to which it could refer some reasonably fundamental questions pertaining to its policies in the income distribution area. That interest was one which competed with the Social Systems Research Institute. And there was no, in my view, there was no need for that kind of competition, but others felt differently. As I've said, the original conception of the SSRI was as an umbrella organization that would house a variety of different kinds of research. I guess Ed Borgata had some research in the organization dealing with small groups that I haven't mentioned before, and certainly was well within the conception of the organization that there should be room for strongly policy-related research, such as what HEW wished to have. The notions that I brought to Wisconsin from the Institute for Social Research in Michigan were that the advantages of having some degree of, or some umbrella organization which covered several academic disciplines and provided a communication ground through which people could use common research tools was, it seemed to me, very important. And certainly the quantitative social sciences were all linked by this need to relate to the computer. To a lesser extent, they were linked by a need to improve upon their methods of data collection, and had an umbrella organization persisted, it might very well have been the case that a good deal of cross-fertilization would have come out of a broad range of research endeavors. In any case, what happened because of the Johnson administration's interest in feeling that it had its umbilical cord with an identifiable research unit, what evolved was a separate organization. And some people who'd been quite strong in the SSRI moved into the Poverty Institute, and in particular Harold Watts, who was brought here through the SSRI, became the first director of the Poverty Institute. So in some way that diminished the capacity of the SSRI to be an eclectic organization, because this other effort was going on that was also eclectic, and it was hard to keep those two balls in the air at one time. And in fact, within a year of its inception, the Poverty Institute was deeply involved in the federal government's plans to run its social experiments, the New Jersey income maintenance experiment, and subsequently other experiments. And so the attention of people in the Poverty Institute was not drawn towards some of the things that had worried Orchid, namely improving the research environment for discovering some general theory of behaviors of individuals and firms. The Poverty Institute was necessarily drawn to much more pragmatic questions of how do we get the job done in terms of designing a social experiment and collecting the data. And equally, because of the mandate that came from Washington to do this and to do it properly, there was, of course, less concern about the level of resources that were involved and the degree of externalities for the research community at large. There was much more of the concern for simply solving the logistic problems, and they were enormous. And so the Poverty Institute group, I think, was to some extent isolated from other elements in the social science research community because of this intense pressure on their time, and they had no particular need to come back to others and get help in less costly ways of solving their problems. So the Poverty Research Institute evolved with something of a disinterest in the whole computer mechanics problems that were in some ways the organizing, where a great deal of energy of the Social Research Institute had been placed. And so the Poverty Institute did its computation where it could and paid the bill, and that was that.
So So it didn't use the SSRI.
So it didn't use the SSRI facilities, and although it developed very substantial capabilities of its own, those capabilities did not, in fact, spin off into any particular way to the benefit of the rest of the university.
The agreement was that they would use SSRI computing facilities and knowledge. Why did they decide not to?
Well, maybe I'm not making myself clear. What I'm really saying is, the kinds of programming effort that were developed, the simulation program that ORCA saw to it that the university acquired when Charlie Holt came here, the basic statistical programs that were developed through its lead programmers and Arnold Zellner, the unified data handler that I referred to, those developments were oriented towards a large body of users and solving a general problem, and they ultimately showed up in some improvement in the computing environment for the university. The Poverty Institute, although it used the computer terminal on the fourth floor, concentrated on solving its immediate problems.
Yeah. No, you did make that clear.
And the Poverty Institute ultimately, because it was collaborating with the Princeton Mathematica Policy Research Group, had to do a good deal of computing by remote from other parts of the country, and really had to deal with a different world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that they purposely set up duplicating facilities. It's simply that the kinds of things that they have done to enhance the capacity of researchers in the Poverty Institute to handle large data bodies have not been picked up by the rest of the university, and it's not so easy to find out about all of that kind of thing.
Hmm. So you think that's a lot of money invested in a direction that didn't benefit the university? Is that the way
to
put it?
Well, no. This is looking at one specific area of activities of the two institutes, and saying, from the computation point of view, the SSRI has had more impact on the university than the Poverty Institute. Mm. If you look at other aspects, the SSRI had a very important advertising role for the university in the mid-60s and early 70s. It's still one of maybe 20 major preprint series in the country that people read very seriously and look for new ideas and new developments. The Poverty Institute has picked up on its own with its own reprint series and its own discussion paper series, and I don't know how you weigh those things. I'm sure the distribution has been larger for the Poverty Institute, and I think it's probably been considerably more influential in terms of changing policy.
Mm-hmm.
But then I don't think that's the way we would like to judge these institutes. We would hope that the institutes are judged in terms of their contribution to knowledge, and on those grounds, I think both institutes have made very substantial contributions. Now, a trend all over the country has been that these preprint and reprint series are trying to charge cost for their publications. And I think that's quite defeating for, you know, dissemination of academic knowledge. And one of the great advantages we've had on the campus up until this point in time is that neither of these institutes has had to charge for disseminating its information. Mm-hmm. And when the Poverty Institute grant funds are terminated in June, then, you know, there's a real possibility that this particular medium for disseminating knowledge will either become so expensive as to be undesirable, or will simply no longer be used. And I think that would be very unfortunate. Well, maybe this long-winded discussion makes you think of some questions you'd like to ask.
I do have a lot of questions. I think it's very useful to have you present it the way you have, because you brought up things that I might have diverted you from if I had started asking questions. If we only have 5 minutes,
Would you like to put it off to another time and ask me questions some other time when you've gone through the interview?
That would be one thing. I have questions independently, but there will also be many that I know arise from mm-hmm. things you've said, so it would be useful to just go through and say, why did that happen, or that sort of thing. So I would, yes, like to, and fairly soon if possible.